Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Holly. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I are going to be working at the Ottawa AFP conference here in a couple of weeks together. It's an exciting upcoming event that we all had to, you, me, and everybody else had to put on pause last year for COVID. And so I'm glad that we're all convening for a virtual event in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do that, let's just ask you to introduce yourself, Holly.
Thank you so much for having me on here today, Jason. So my name is Holly Wagg, and I'm a fundraising professional. Currently, I am the partner and CEO of Good Works, which is a fundraising agency based out of Ottawa, Ontario. We kind of specialize in three areas of giving: annual giving, legacy giving, and digital giving. So we are definitely the ones who are working with your large pool of donors who are making those smaller, you know, $25 to $1,000 gifts generally, who are really sort of often like the most underappreciated and undervalued donors, I like to say. I've been a fundraising professional for close to 25 years now. I started off on the marketing and communications side. I really started my career working in small shops, which I absolutely love and still have my heart to this day. So being the generalist, doing every type of fundraising possible. And I've been on the consulting side for about 9 years now.
Wow, Holly. It sounds like you and I have a very similar path. I started about early 2001, right before September 11th. Does that sound right? Or were you a little prior to that?
I started in like 97, 98 while I was doing my undergrad. Yeah. So similar though.
Okay. So you were in college. So I bet you and I are like, so Holly, you were in high school in the early 90s. Am I right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you guys watch the Dairy Girls? Do you watch that show? Are you familiar with the show?
The Dairy Girls?
The Dairy Girls on Netflix. Yeah. Are you familiar with the show?
I have not watched The Dairy Girls.
Oh my gosh. You have to. So it's about these four girls. It's been on Netflix. You know, we're all sort of streaming these things for the last year, you know, watching them in mass. But it's about these four girls in Derry, Ireland. And growing up in Ireland in the 90s, early 90s, you know, a lot of the challenges were going on there. It was a mess.
but it's in the early 90s. And so anybody just like you and me totally understands what life was like in the early 90s. You have to watch it.
Oh, it sounds so good. I've been trying to get my youngest daughter, who's just turned 10. I've been trying to, she watched the Gilmore Girls. So that's like a little bit later in the 90s. Yeah. And I've been trying to get her to go back and watch Felicity, but she will not bite on Felicity. Every other romantic, horrible teenage show she loves, but Felicity, for some reason, she's not into, much to my
shame. It's funny you mentioned, because we've got two boys and two girls, and I've watched through probably because they made me, and I really enjoy. So my 12-year-old doesn't understand why I like the Dairy Girls so much, and very much like because they haven't. There's nothing quote unquote inappropriate about the way that they project. They basically they're just teenagers, right? And so there's a level of purity that almost you find in the Gilmore Girls show, you know, my daughter can't get her head wrapped. My 12-year-old's like, why do you like the Dairy Girls so much? Why do you watch it? And I'm like, because they're not doing things that I didn't do or didn't want to do at, you know, 14 years old in high school. And so it's anyway, you should check it out. If you've got a daughter too, and you grew up if you were in high school, and obviously we all have a sense of history and what was happening in Ireland. So you should definitely check it out.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll add it to my watching list.
Yeah. Holly, sorry for the Dairy Girl rabbit trail, but we like to invite our guests to come on here and have a big idea or bold opinion about fundraising. And so what do you got for us this morning?
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like there's so many things I could talk about. And I know at AFP Ottawa Chapters Fundraising Day, I'm actually sitting on a panel for LGBTQ professionals. So talking about what it's like to be queer and working in the profession. But having listened to a couple of other episodes of your podcast, one of the things that you really made me question, or I feel like we could have like this really animated debate or conversation, is what is really the role of annual giving? Because I know a lot you're talking small shop, but you're doing major gift fundraising, and you talk about coming into the profession and specializing too early. And we're actually facing this opposite problem, is where we very much struggle to find people who know annual giving, people who know direct mail, who have that deep experience to be able to come to work for us on the consulting side, but even just generally in organizations, finding somebody who's got five to 10 years of direct mail experience, legacy or digital, they just don't exist. They're like little unicorns, big unicorns, maybe.
Yeah, I think that I've actually got Epstein's book right here in front of me, and you've probably heard me talk about this before, this notion of early specialization. And I think what most concerns me about when we talk about the quote unquote annual fund is this idea that we sort of specialize in a space that is constantly evolving. And it's not the necessity or the lack of necessity of quote unquote the annual fund, or I'm generally, you know, I would sort of characterize as that place where those initial gifts sort of happen. Mm-hmm. But it's the fact that the place at which, and I don't want to hijack, I want to hear your thoughts just as perhaps as much as you want to hear mine. And I like it when my guests come on here with a sort of something that we can banter on back and forth about. But it's the idea that direct mail, for example, is probably not going to work. In my opinion, direct mail is probably not going to work past our parents' generation. We're going to transition to a more online, like everybody gets themselves tied up in knots over Charity Water, for example. I think not because new acquisition or the annual fund doesn't exist at Charity Water, but because Charity Water does it all online. Do you follow what I'm saying?
They do, but I will disagree with you. And we're actually doing research to dig into more about what mail is going to look like for the boomer, you know, Gen X and millennial cohorts. Because what we've actually found is that millennials are direct mail responsive, which is shocking, right? You would think like, why would a millennial? So, you know, somebody's like 25 plus, sure, like the mail. And what we hear is that my inbox is so full. I get hundreds of emails every day. I don't look at them. but nobody sends me anything in the mail. There's tons of real estate and marketplace available for that particular audience. If you can figure out how to get them on your list, how to get the mail in their mailbox, and then what kind of mail that they're actually going to respond to. Yeah. So I think that's like, to me, is I actually, one of the things that you can see even last year, if you were looking at the data, you know, Blackbaud produced the report and they said that online giving was up 23% in Canada. I think it was 21% in the States. That shouldn't surprise anybody. But what we actually done with our clients, and we started to look last year, our direct mail programs with COVID, I mean, they did amazing last year. Our integrated programs, they all blew the projections out of the water. Our clients all had, you know, some of the best fundraising years that they've ever historically had. We're getting more investment into direct mail this year because of that, especially because events weren't going to be able to perform and produce revenue. Major gifts are down. All of those other sorts of things are happening. But what's fascinating is when we look at the folks who got the mail, but didn't make a gift to the mail back on that coupon, but went online, whether they searched that online or they got the email, it's like they move those channels. And when we actually found with other clients who've taken away the mail, their online giving decreases. So one of the cool things that we get to start testing out is actually figuring out how much mail is the right amount of mail to drive it online and how much credit do we give the mail? Because generally in not-for-profit marketing, we're using a last touch attribution model, which means the only channel that gets credit is literally the place that the donor was that we can track right before they made their gift. So to me, I actually don't think direct mail is dying or dead or is already going to go with the civic generation. We already see it well in hand and performing well with the boomers. I think the question is like, how do we communicate even better and even stronger with these, you know, disruption moments that we're already seeing and trying and testing out with our clients?
Okay. So, and that's the, so you and I have been around about the same time. And so that's the first fundamental question I think all of us have to wrestle with when at Responsive, we have basically our three lanes. And our three lanes, the first lane is where we acquired the initial gift. The second lane is not what I characterize as the is oftentimes confused with major giving. And the middle lane is actually where we reconcile and sort of form a meaningful relationship that can be counted on with the existing donor. That can be done in the mail. That can be at events. Oftentimes people assume it's just simply a major donor. And then the third lane is where these relationships sort of reach their more transformative sort of places where both sides of the exchange are experiencing something in an extraordinary way. So I guess the first thing that we could sort of really just banter about for a while here on this point, the thing about lane one that I like to really get sort of young fundraisers to really get their heads wrapped around is, sure, direct mail is working. And if direct mail works 20 years from now, great. But is it and will it, if lane one fundraising activities are always going to be generally driven by volume and efficiency, that's basically what lane one does. So whether we're talking about galas, golf tournaments, putting things in the mail, online giving, Giving Tuesday, they're all basically driven by volume and efficiency. And when they're driven by volume and efficiency, and they oftentimes are very characteristic of consumer behavior, right? They basically align with consumer behavior. When consumer confidence tanks, which it generally happens about every 7 to 10 years anyway, right? That means that lane one is basically going to collapse if we're too invested in it. And that's what probably concerns me most, is that we have a world that's becoming increasingly unpredictable. And events like September 11th and the recession and COVID-19 perhaps could become more and more regular to us. And if we overly invest in what I call lane one, so it's not an overinvestment or a picking on direct mail, you're always going to need some new acquisition and some lane one type of activity. But we also need to be very cognizant of the fact that lane one is going to collapse on you when consumer confidence tanks. Does that make sense?
Yes and no. So I guess the thing is, we want to call it in your terminology. And I've looked at your model, and I really would like to find written descriptions of it, because I was, you know, looking at pictures and trying to figure it out. And you've explained it a bit here, which is great. But These are the, okay. So my number one issue with fundraising. So if we take this as the Blaine sort of approach, it's still a very much siloed approach. It doesn't ever assume that a donor has a relationship with your organization, regardless of what channel they choose to give, who they give to, whatever the connection is. And so one of the things I'm constantly telling my fundraisers is, like, you know, we always talk about mid-level giving. How do we leverage up and get people to give more money? And my whole thing is that if somebody's giving you $25 or they're giving you $25,000, generally for those people, that's a gift within their means. And what makes that $25,000 person feel like they're not like you? Like, sometimes staff are afraid to ask for those big gifts. And I was like, just so you know, that $25,000 gift is your $25 gift. You stretched, you know, that university student who stretched dinner for a week. You know, like, we're very much,
You and I are gonna be so much on the same page by the end of this conversation, because I'm not picking on direct mail. I'm not saying direct mail is gonna go anywhere. All I'm saying is that lane one fundraising activity is always very much like consumer behavior at one. It's generally based on volume and efficiency. And the one more thing I want us to keep in mind about lane one fundraising is it inevitably experiences diminishing returns. Anything that's based on volume and efficiency will inevitably hit diminishing returns unless you change. And all of our marketing friends are going to agree with this, and all of our economist friends are going to agree with this. Unless you change the nature of the relationship, which means after they've given you $125 on Giving Tuesday, if you do not change the nature of that relationship, some variable has to change. If you don't, and you just continue on that continuum, you're basically going to reach a point of diminishing returns, and then eventually a point of negative returns, and the relationship will collapse. And that's why donors are not renewing after 2 to 3 years.
So what I would say to that, so I'm now following you more. So we just talk about, you know, people being afraid to ask for different types of gifts and you know, realizing that value to that person. But the point that I think is different is that we do relational fundraising. We are not into transactional fundraising. We are not the people who are sending out. And we also remember Canadian files are a lot smaller, right, than American files. Sure. So like a small charity under 5,000 donors, a mid-size, you know, direct mail program is somewhere probably between 5,000, 30 to 50,000 records, and large for us would be above 50,000 records. So we also have greater relationship opportunities, but we're not working with our clients to send out, you know, 100, 200,000 acquisition pieces that are all premium, getting the donors in the door and trying to milk them all that we're worth. What I'd like to say about these lanes is that our job is as the first sort of touch point or multiple touch points, given the lower value of them, is to build that relationship, to make that donor fall in love with you. And you can never, and I hate it when charities do this, do not look at my annual donor just at the value for their annual gifts. Look at their lifetime value, but also how you've leveraged them, particularly in the area of planned giving, because we actually creating revenue models that talks about, because we know that 90 to 95% of gifts and wills in Canada's, I don't think that's any different in the States, are gifts to charities or charitable quests are gifts and wills. So let's clarify that. But we also know that 70% of direct mail donors have left a gift in their will. They are more apt to write a will, leave the gift in the will. So if you are thinking of your direct mail donors or your online donors through an integrated experience, just for the value of their income that they can give to you today, you are not looking at that whole relationship and that potential of that person once you've developed the relationship with them to have them become invested in your cause and make that truly transformative gift.
So the lanes, I didn't mean to... So the lanes are not intended to improve fundraising. The lanes are basically intended. So if you think about the way that fundraising sort of finds itself, and I'm talking about this in the forthcoming book, comes out in September. I really wanted to have it in Ottawa, and I don't. It's not ready to go. All the final drafts go to the publisher this week. But I don't think our challenges are understanding the difference between how effective direct mail is, galas, golf tournaments, major gifts. I don't think our challenges in fundraising are that. Holly, I think our challenges are actually that we do not understand how to appropriately place all of these tools in our toolbox. We don't, it's a weakness of organizational design and professional development. And if we could get organizational design right, I put these three lanes in front of organizations because I want them to know how to create three thriving lanes. Direct mail, or whatever is the equivalent of direct mail, is always going to exist inside of an organization, and it can play out in all three lanes. But what essentially these three lanes represent is it's the organizational design that recognizes that a donor is going to move through a series of decisions. It's also based on not on outcomes, but on the process that the donor is walking through as they make more increasingly meaningful and significant decisions on behalf of the organization. Those initial gifts, generally, as I refer to them as trivial gifts, they're generally not well thought out, you know, internalized sort of decisions to support the organization for the rest of their life. It's not about the size of the gift at all. It's completely about the sort of the underlying decision-making process. Kahneman talked about this in Thinking Fast and Slow. It's just it's not about whether it's a $125 gift or about a $25,000 gift. I've received, on behalf of the charities I've worked for, I've received very trivial, by definition of the decision being made, $25,000 gifts. So what I'm looking for is the acknowledgement that first, we have a strategy that first of all compels those initial gifts, then moves them into a much more meaningful series of gifts, which plays out in the middle lane and moves you out of the risk of collapsing in the midst of a turnaround or a drop in the economy, and moves you away from the relationship that's just solely on a one-directional talking to them, for example. It actually reflects a true communication back and forth. You can do that in the mail. You can do that at special events. You just have to understand that your donor is now making a different type of decision than they were making when they gave you that gift on Giving Tuesday.
Yeah.
And take this out of the context of, take this conversation out of the context of direct mail, because I understand you're doing direct mail. But think about all of the organizations that were doing fundraising in March of 2020, mm-hmm. right when they were invested in what I would call lane one fundraising. In that case, it looked like a bunch of special events. The economy comes along, an unpredictable event comes along, consumer confidence tanks, and they don't know what to do. Because when an unpredictable event, everything in lane one is based on predictability and control. You have to be able to forecast it. Everything largely in direct response is based on the ability to predict and control. But you can't predict and control events like September 11th. You can't predict and control things like COVID-19. And you certainly can't predict a recession. You can't predict these sorts of things. And so that's what primarily concerns me about being overly, and that's what I say when I say we're overly invested in this type of fundraising.
I think that's interesting. I mean, I wish I knew more about the science of predicting things, but we know pandemics happen every 100 years. I think this one's 120. We know that stock market cycles, right? Which then takes the bottom out of your major gifts program. Every 10 years, sort of ups and downs, you know, we have those bear and bull markets. I think what the thing that you're talking about is that some charities, when they're setting up their structure, they have this transactional approach. It's give me all of your money. And that's all that they think is the donor is for cash cow, versus the clients that we choose to work with and come and work with us. And it's the way I personally believe in fundraising. And it's why I love what I do, because it's all about relationships and telling those stories and connecting that donor with the recipient, with a recipient of that cause. And that's the piece of the work that I love most. But I will tell you time and time again, I think the best part about consulting is you really get a good sense of which charities you would ever want to be a staff member with and which ones you might not want to go and work inside, because they're all structured so differently, although technically we're all doing the same thing. It's very interesting. And I would say in the last 5 years, I've seen more organizational shakeups at the attempts to break down silos and getting donors to be treated as a human being through all different stages and connections with organizations. And I think that is probably one of the biggest challenges facing leadership in the sector right now, is how to do that, is to restructure charities to be more effective going forward.
Okay. So last year, in September, mm-hmm. In the fall. I started in, so in the spring, we all encounter. So if you think about the way 2020 played out, we had three relatively unpredictable sort of narratives playing out in the headlines. The first one was COVID-19, and that affected our bottom line in terms of special events. Then during the summer, we had the event in Minneapolis, the George Floyd murder, the social unrest, and a lot of organizations started to see not a decline in giving, but a redirection in giving. So people were prioritizing their money towards things like Black Lives Matter. And so like my local college, I was explaining this to my students last night. If your parents or grandparents, for example, were giving to a particular charity, but they really cared about the Black Lives Matter movement, they might have reprioritized their giving. So it wasn't that giving went down. It's just that giving went to other places. That's what happened last summer. But in the fall, and I don't know if you guys were seeing this I don't think you all were seeing this in Canada, but in the fall, Holly, and this relates to direct mail, and it'd be interesting to hear what your thoughts, what you would be saying to a client, similar to what you might have been saying to a client in the spring as it relates to special events. But literally every month and this is some of the stuff I quote in my new book, every month in the fall, so September, October, November, and December, there was a headline that was basically saying to the world that the American Postal Service, the U.S. Postal Service, was going to collapse. Mm-hmm. It was going to collapse. And that's 6 months after COVID-19 basically did collapse their event strategy. And so if you're the consultant who's selling direct mail and your client is reading month after month after month that the U.S. Post, and it didn't collapse. We basically put some funding in it. We put the necessary funding in it. And thank God Donald Trump got out of office. But had Donald Trump not gotten out of office, we don't know that for political reasons, he wouldn't have let that thing crash. And so if your clients were reading the Postal Service is going to collapse, what are you saying to them?
I laugh because it's one of the primary differences is our postal service is a crown corporation. So that's like not going to happen to us in Canada. And so it's just, again, a very different when you also have a social safety net. The way our societies are so much operate differently because let's go back to the beginning of 2020. So I actually am in a very unusual position compared to most fundraisers. So my wife, Julia, who is no longer alive, so I think that's important to know. I'm also widowed. Jules died in 2017 from leukemia. But in Jules's career, Jules was a pandemic planner. So I actually have lived through pandemic planning for H1N1 already. So from all of that, I have all of this training and sort of knowledge from having lived that experience. And she was working at the time for NAV Canada, who's in charge of air traffic control, which in a pandemic, theoretically at the time, back in 2009, the first thing that's supposed to go down is your cash. So they say there's a run on cash. And that's before we had so much of a credit card society. So they say the cash machines run out and then your airline shut down. And then eventually it leads to absenteeism and then they'll shut down your workforce. Not necessarily because people are sick yet, but because everybody's taking care of one another. Nobody's coming into the office. They're scared, whatever. So when this pandemic hit, I immediately was with my staff team and with my clients and saying, okay, this is 2 years, guys, 5 years in all likelihood, but this is 2 years. We need to have a 2-year plan. And so we sort of guided and coached our clients through what they could expect. I'm delighted that we got a vaccine, you know, theoretically out in under a year. I'm surprised. I didn't think it was going to happen for 2 years, but we still have variants and that's changed our sort of long run. But we were able to position ourselves in terms of annual giving quite well in terms of COVID. And we were in Canada, I would say, impacted, but lesser so to Black Lives Matter. A lot of our conversations then became around inequities with different racial groups, particularly our First Nations, people who've been treated absolutely horribly. But the Postal Service in the election, other than watching what was happening down in the States and being glad that it wasn't happening here, we were pretty much untouched. So you come to the question that you asked me, what would I do if our Postal Service was collapsing? I kind of throw my hands up because like, if the way you deliver your fundraising message can no longer be delivered, your channel is automatically cut off.
And that's what,
Yeah.
Okay. And that's my critique on lane one. So don't think that I'm picking on Gala's Golf Tournaments, Giving Tuesday, or direct mail. Think that I'm basically critiquing that part of our fundraising system that's based on predictability. And some parts of our world are not predictable. I mean, think about the Cambia incident that happened in 2016, Give America online giving Give Day campaign. You know, thousands of organizations around the U.S. are basically relying on this Give America campaign, and their systems basically collapsed. These systems totally collapsed. But those systems are all based on volume and efficiency, and these systems are becoming so complex that you cannot predict where something's going to happen. And so what moving into the middle lane does, whatever method of interaction you're using, I don't think Joseph Tainter basically studied how societies collapse or how social systems collapse. And it's not because they didn't use complexity. It's because they did use complexity. So societies collapse because we put more complexity into our system. And what I'm trying to do with my three lanes is try to move donors out of complexity into them. So the outermost lane is generally going to be the most complex lane that you could possibly have.
Yeah.
And so it's going to have all that system. And if you think about what's happening with direct response versus think about what's happening with direct mail, which would have been what you and I would have come into at the beginning of our careers, versus those who are literally trying to transition that entire system to an electronic web-based sort of system and continue to grow that donor population within that system. As long as you're doing that, you're just adding layer and layer and layer of complexity. And it's going to become so complex that you and I could not look at it, even as well-trained experts in knowing direct response. We would have no idea what's going to happen at any particular moment. And the whole system could just cascade down in a complete mess.
Then my question to that is like, what is the solution, right? Because there's no channel, right, of fundraising or lane, whatever you want to call them, that has 100% certainty and predictability. You know, stock markets crash.
I'm not looking for this.
Yeah, it's being a diversified, right? Like your whole strategy has to be, what is your diversification strategy?
Well, the systems. System scientists have been looking. You look for redundant. You basically build into your system. You build redundancy and simplicity into your system. And if you want to build redundancy and simplicity into your system, you learn how to take people out to lunch. You find 150 donors. You find 150 donors out of your. I mean, I worked with a client here, Holly, who was a direct response, one of the largest direct response company, who was contracted with one of the largest direct response companies here in the country, in the U.S. And I had a contract major gift officer on staff with the organization that company and myself were serving. And the direct response company deliberately told my client and their client not to provide my contract major gift officer with names for which to basically move out of lane one and move into lane two. So we're talking about changing the nature of the relationship. We're talking about the fact that your donors have to come through the lane one. They have to come through the annual fund, through Gala's Golf Tournaments, direct response. But at some point, you have to say, okay, in order to weather the unpredictable nature of our world, we're going to have to take a handful of our donors and move them away from a dependency on these things. And we're also simultaneously going to have to raise the expectation of these relationships because we know some of them can give bigger gifts. It's not an anti-direct response. It's a more comprehensive system that's designed to thrive.
It is, but I think your argument is sort of twofold. Is one in part you're saying you can't have these high volume, relationships all the time or to be dependent upon it because they'll crash. But so will the relational fundraising, right? There'll be times like the literally one-to-one face-on-face. There'll be times when that won't work because that money is not there, right? There'll be times when foundations don't work because, you know, their assets have been so hit and they're not giving out money. But I think the issue that you're speaking to is this, again, this one of organizational structures where we all know it. We all have certain causes or charities where, you know, direct mail has a target of $1 million this year. Online has a target of $1.5 million. And donors are going to say between those two different channels. And then they're fighting internally about who gets credit for what gift because they have a total versus we're not looking at how of our donors then, you know, how many of them are prospects for this particular project, you know, that could have that face-to-face meeting? How many of them are leaving gifts and wills? We're not looking at donors as independent sort of autonomous beings who are going to give in a way that makes sense to them, to the causes that give. We try to fix them literally because I don't want to use the same metaphor. So I need like a better metaphor, but like, it's like you know, because it's a laneway metaphor that I want to use, right? So they can stick to their own, I don't know. Goodness, I'm a lack for meta. I'm picturing my kid eating granola bars. Like they're just stuck in the granola bar box. You know, like that's all I can think of.
So, I think the predicament that we have. So I was talking to one of my trainers yesterday. So we have trainers around the country, and we teach these trainers to basically help organizations build into their thinking, into their clients' thinking, these three lanes, so that you can create a comprehensive system that creates three distinct lanes. That basically builds in the redundancy and it's the same thing that system scientists would do to basically, if you're looking at a forest, for example, an ecologist would tell you that if you don't want your entire forest to burn down, you build roads in between your trees. That's all you do. You basically build in some margins and you don't try to maximize. It's like the cornfield in my backyard. If it's all one species, if all your donors are experiencing fundraising in all the exact same way, you're going to run the risk of a collapse. And so what we're doing is we're basically trying to create these three distinct lanes, three distinct types of relationships. And we're hoping that basically one contributes to the other so that the system doesn't run the risk of basically collapsing at some point. And so if organizations want to get overly invested in anything, I don't care what they get invested in. You overly invest in 12 major donors, 12 old white guys, 12 white, arrogant white guys, and you're going to be in a lot of trouble, just like you would be in a lot of trouble if you were overly invested in direct response, right?
And that's exactly, I think we're on the same page here, like in terms of the culture of how we move people, right? So I can give an example. You know, we have a client who was really super keen on developing a mid-level giving program, and that for them was anybody who gave over $1,000. So for years, we've been communicating with this group of donors through the mail. They were giving, they were raising the revenue. All of a sudden, they decided these people need a more responsive touch. Okay. But what they did is they pulled them out of the mail program and then sat on them and then didn't meet with them face to face, didn't do any other action. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, why is our direct mail revenue down? Well, because you took some of these people out and now you've actually stopped entirely communicating with them. And then they never ended up developing the program. So for them, it was thinking about, again, donors as cash cows, about how they could leverage them for more dollars instead of thinking about their relationship and connection. And time again, that is something that we see happening that we caution and, you know, we counsel and we work with our staff members. Like, why are you all of a sudden changing how you're communicating with someone? Has there been any indication that they would like something different? Have they shown a willingness that they want to sit down at a table with you? Because some donors don't want that. And some donors are so delighted to have that opportunity. So it's like, how are you asking your donors what it is that they want when you're deciding how you're going to move them along, you know, in their journey and deepening that relationship with you?
Okay. So I've had a number of guests, and I don't know if you've listened to I had a gentleman who was on here on the podcast about 6 months ago, and we were talking about diversity, equity, inclusion being built into our direct response and other fundraising strategies. And what we know about systems is when you bring diversity into the system, you bring a degree of uncertainty and unpredictableness. And I think that's what essentially all of our friends in direct response are going to have to wrestle with, because what you're seeing in our society right now is a desire to have a more diverse and equitable and inclusive sort of pool of donors. We want our donors to represent a different sort of, you know, we want a broader, less homogeneous sort of population than what we currently have in our database. But to do that is going to require that we build into a degree of comfort you're just going to have to be comfortable with the fact that your outcomes are not nearly as predictable as they historically have been. That cornfield in my backyard, because it's all basically one species, comes out of the ground in very predictable ways, and it basically yields an extremely efficient crop. That's the problem with our direct response systems for the last several decades. When you tell me you want a more diverse pool of donors coming through your system, you're going to build into it a degree of unpredictability, and you're not going to know what the outcomes are. And because that unpredictability is there, you might be surprised. You might find that a more diverse donor pool is actually extraordinarily more generous than the white, suburban, affluent individuals that are built into your system now. But you don't know that, and you're not going to know that until they actually dare to go and do that.
And I think you have to combine that with, what is fundraising's role / where do they get invited to the table on the programmatic and mission side? Because often we're asked to do these things, but there's also fundamental inequities and barriers in our own organizations and hiring practices from the communities that we're supposed to serve in the first place, right? And you know, I think about that. Like, I can give an example. Years ago. So when I first moved here to Ottawa, I had worked in summer camps actually in the States, serving kids of LGBTQ families. So that's where kids who had a lesbian, you know, gay, bisexual, transgender parent. And at first, as a queer person, I was not sure why our children needed this summer camp program or a space of their own, because in my mind, they weren't necessarily experiencing the same sort of discrimination that I would have been, or the challenges that I've faced as you know, a queer person. You know, the only time I've ever been fired from a job was working at a summer camp at the age of 23, and it was in the States where there's no protection. And I got, when it was found out that I was a lesbian, it was not appropriate for me to be working with their children, they said. And it was very insinuating about what that was about. And that's the only time I've ever been fired in my entire life was for being gay. I didn't do anything wrong. You know, so what we did, we started this program here in Ottawa called the Ten Oaks Project that Jules and I formed, which is the first organization of its kind in Canada to offer a summer camp program for LGBTQ youth and children of LGBTQ families. And the very first question of even like diversity in the own LGBTQ community we faced is, when we went to another organization and we asked if they would be interested in partnering and helping us set up the program, they're like, What are you talking about? There are nobody with children here in Ottawa. They're like, gay people don't have kids. And we're like, what are you talking about? And it really was 10 years earlier. So this is about 2001-ish, 2002-ish. 10 years earlier, there had been a big gay boom in Toronto. And that gay boom was starting here in Ottawa, whereas that there's a lot of families that, you know, that have a mom and a dad broke up. One of the parents came out. Now they had kids, you know, and then families were, you know, women and men were starting to have children of their own. But we even experienced that of people saying, this will never work. This doesn't exist within the community. We started this organization and there was such a need and a hunger. And like our first summer, we had 25 kids come. Now we have waiting lists every summer. There's over 200 kids. We have all of these programs that we offer year round. And within five years, we got a Lifetime Achievement Award for setting up this organization. Like, talk about change and transition and even diversity in a diverse community. Like, it was so fun within such a short period of time to make that change.
But it doesn't, if I heard in between the lines, you didn't know if that was going to work either. I mean, as someone who's doing it, you didn't know if that was actually, there's an unpredictability there. When you think about all the aspirations, a lot of them are qualitative aspirations that are coming into sort of the conversation about fundraising right now and what we're going to have to be okay with. So if you think about where this conversation started and where we've landed here, we're basically talking about a qualitative turn in fundraising practices. That's what we're basically talking about. We want our experiences to be qualitatively different, both for quite frankly, for both sides of the relationship. So don't make it all about the donor and don't tell me it's all about the organization. How about we just sort of holistically look at this about the interdependency between a grander system? And how about we look at the fact that we want to aspire to things that we haven't actually done before, and we're going to have to get more comfortable with the unpredictable nature of our world. So whether we're talking about these, what I call in my book, the big three, September 11th, the recession and COVID-19, or whether we're just simply talking about the fact that I want a more diverse donor pool for my local organization here in Ottawa, you're going to have to be okay with the fact that your direct response consultant isn't going to be able to tell you that this is absolutely going to work. You're going to have to be more exploratory because that's essentially what you just described. We can go for another 18 minutes. We won't lose our listeners for another 18 minutes. So what I tell my trainers is, We want to be what's called a solution shop, and a solution shop is not the shop that actually delivers on things like solutions, which, I mean, is not the ones who actually implements, but it's actually the ones who help the organization solve problems. But I was saying to one of my colleagues the other day, I said, I want you to know who to partner with. And basically, we're talking about partnering with people like Holly, like yourself, Holly, who understand the messy complexity of our radically uncertain world and can build that uncertainty into systems like direct response.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that, Holly, you are a different generation of direct response, annual fund, whatever you sort of describe yourself. You are a different generation than the generations you and I are following behind, because they have been trying to capitalize on a white, straight, primarily male sort of demographic for decades, and we've all inherited it. And the mess that we're in the midst of right now is trying to create very different. I mean, I watched when Robert Smith, black gentleman who gave $40 million to Morehouse College. I talked about this on the podcast several times. $40 million. I watched how our white colleagues responded to that gift and immediately went to, we're going to critique the fact that he didn't do it according to our rules. I watched that play out on social media and I thought, look, people, if he was a white, rich guy, you know, if he was every profile with the donor that you're consistently comfortable with, you wouldn't have an issue with how he chose to give that gift. It's because somebody did something that's outside your paradigm, right? It's because somebody's behaving in a way that's complete. They didn't expect a really rich black guy to pay off the student loans for every kid in that particular class.
Love that story.
Right. Yeah. It's awesome. It's totally awesome. I mean, and so until we get comfortable with this unpredictable world that we're in, I'm watching all these donor-centered folks fighting with our friends out in Seattle. I'm like, you know what, people, our friends in Seattle just want you to be more prepared for a more diverse world that's not going to look like the donor you had 50 years ago. At the core of it, that's basically what it is. They're not the bad guys. And yet all of our donor-centered fundraising friends are digging in their heels on the fact that, oh my gosh, if we can't say it's not donor-centered anymore, it's going to like totally blow up the system. No, it's not. It's actually going to better prepare you for the future.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do love the work that they're doing out in Seattle and followed it. I don't agree with all of it. Some of it I want to, you know,
I don't either.
The point is that we are the people doing this thinking. And so what I love about this, so I guess where maybe till now I haven't thought of myself as being sort of a different fundraiser-ish. When I started my career in annual, it was on the digital side. And because I started in small startup organizations, they were not organizations that had direct mail programs at all well or established. It wasn't like I was building digital on top of anything. I was starting fundraising from scratch with digital, which I think gives you like an entirely different perspective on how to build relationships, build a program, get people engaged in your work, giving them opportunities to shape the work. You know, and I come from a very community organizing background, you know, having started a charity and run one and been part of many, many sort of startup phases. But for me going forward is what I love at GoodWorks is that we work with our clients and we are now challenging how they do fundraising. So for example, once we have your direct mail and digital program up to where it's meeting all of the sector benchmarks, which aren't fantastic, so a lot of them are American based upon bigger volume and transactions, so we're always much higher than that. And then they've met their own internal, you know, benchmarks. So we know that there's no holes, right? We know your renewal rates are looking good. We know that your long-term donor value, you've maximized that. Your upgradation is going fantastic. We are actually going out and testing these approaches. So we are putting out mailings that are a little off-brand message, you know, typically what they would do, attracting and speaking to new donor pools. We're putting out different engagement strategies through lead generation online to bring in new groups of donors. We have all of our clients are now are ready to do that. I would say like 95% of them. Some of them are newer to us and we're still figuring out what's making them work, what's making their donors tick. But I get excited about that. I get super jazzed that like our research project that we're starting is called Not Your Grandma's DM. And we are actually going to be, we've designed the sort of framework of questions, and we're looking at how we can make that a collaborative research project with charities across the country to start saying, let's test. Let's start to figure out what is going to work in this space, because we don't actually agree. 20 years from now, direct mail will be equally as relevant. But if we stay continuing to deliver these best practices of civic mail, it sure as hell won't. We're going to write ourselves into obsolescence. You know, we're just going to do it ourselves. But I'm not interested in doing that. I see a role for it. I have a hunch. My gut tells me that I'm right. And the thing we need to figure out is how to do it. And we can't do that alone, you know? So I guess my background academically is all participatory sort of learning. And this is going to be participatory fundraising. I love it.
Isn't that so? All businesses. So if you and I were sitting, you know, 20 years ago, if we were sitting in our college classrooms and our business professor was sitting at the front of the room, he or she would be basically saying to us that all businesses sort of balance the difference between exploratory and exploitive sort of work. Exploitive and exploratory are not good and bad words. It's just you exploit what you understand and what you know, and you explore what you don't. You explore the unfamiliar and you exploit the familiar. And is it fair to say that what our friends in Seattle are basically asking us to do is to begin to explore the unfamiliar? Is that really all they're asking us to do? And so how does that translate to the consulting work that you and I might do? That's what you just basically described. You're basically saying, let's explore some spaces. That's what you basically said you did with your camps. And when you talk about being sent away from the camp that you went at here in the United States, it's because they wanted to explore. They wanted to continue to exploit what was familiar to them. Mm-hmm. And because you were, quote unquote, unfamiliar to them, that's why they sent you home.
Yeah. I love it. It's a good break. I agree with you. And I think this is larger speaking to the fundraising profession. And so, I mean, I remember when I was first starting out, I got a small shop bursary to go to AFP Congress in Toronto. And I was so excited because I was always working by myself, right? I didn't know how direct mail worked. I didn't really know how digital all worked, all these big systems and major fundraising. And I remember sitting down at a lunchtime table. And I remember, you know, it was a fancy table, right? So we had all the table settings or whatnot. And I had many different people at my table. And there was a bit of awkwardness about it. And I'm a very direct person. And, you know, I was joking to the person next to me about these table settings and like how I could never remember which to use the fork or the knife. It was like an icebreaker. And this person is a very well-respected and senior fundraiser. And it can only be said, and I really wish I could remember the exact words, but in the Southern American accent. So, you know, when it's like sounds really polite, but it's actually quite cutting what they're trying to say to you. Okay. So this person had this to me was like, you know, it was basically, my dear, if you've never learned how to use proper etiquette, you will never progress in your career to major gifts. And at that moment, I thought to myself, I was like, if this is what it means to be a major gifts officer, I'm never working a major
gifts.
Are you kidding me? Like, I don't know which fork to use. I can't build relationships with people. Actually, I'm really good
at that. How old were you? Remind me how old you were in that scenario.
I look young, talk young. So maybe 28 or 30. Like, you know, still really young.
Oh, okay.
But maybe
you were still pretty formative. You were still in sort of a Yeah, those are the types. So I just had a get, in fact, the conversation broadcast today, I think we have been told a story. Fieri talks about this. You probably heard me talking. I know my listeners have heard me talk about Fieri was talking to the children about the way that children were educated in Brazil.
And we have been told to be oppressed.
Yes, yes, exactly. We have been taught a story about how fundraising works and what is happening right now. So I've been taught a story too, Holly. I grew up, my parents are from South Georgia. I come from white, straight, evangelical, conservative roots. And I have basically been taught how to not know how to comfortably sit in a room with an individual like yourself and have a meaningful conversation and develop a friendship and collaborate. That's the world I come from, right? Mm-hmm. That's the summer camp that you were basically employed at. That's that summer camp. And what the world is telling us is you're going to have to, what the world is telling us is that that's all going away. That's all going away. And that's the reason why we didn't reelect President Trump. And that's the way, that's why things like Black Lives Matter happened last summer. That's where the world's going. That's why our friends out in Seattle are doing what they're doing, is because they're saying that the world is changing and you guys better get on this train and you better come with us, or you're basically going to, or your systems are going to collapse.
I think the best thing about the things in Seattle is they're not saying you better come this way because, you know, you better get on our systems. They're telling you you're wrong and it is. And if you want to be part of it, you can and you can't. But that is, that's fundamentally even the way our profession has approached the diversity and inclusion work, right? There's this assumption, this is philanthropy. And then they're like, why are these diverse communities not coming to the way that we do it? Which is basically what you've talked about. White male centered philanthropy, all about giving from rich people, right? And so the whole, even I remember sitting in all of these little sessions, and the whole point was, how come we're not recognizing the way, what I felt the true conversation was, that these communities, diverse communities, are giving back, you know? So like, I think of my daughter, and my daughter is half Caucasian, half Sri Lankan. And so her donor is Sri Lankan and his family immigrated. They fled for their lives from Sri Lanka during the revolution. Okay.
Yes.
When their family raises money, it goes back to family members that are still in Sri Lanka who are suffering, you know, from poverty. It goes directly back to the community and the businesses there. They don't write a check to the local hospital and they don't write a check to the charity down the street, but they might be giving it to their church because their church is running a distribution sort of model. Like there is money and there's tons of fundraising and there's tons of capacity, but it doesn't look like through these typical charitable norms, which we have somehow as fundraising professionals have said, well, this is the only way that you can give, right? Like this is philanthropy. This is the only way philanthropy works. And like, see, the work that's being done with community-centric fundraising is challenging that very notion of what is philanthropy. It starts down at that definition. And I think all of us have sat at enough fundraising dinners. And, you know, if we look at the Phil's Awards or whatever, everybody gets up there and defines philanthropy as the first thing they do. It's a love of humankind. And is that really what we're doing every single day in our jobs? Like, I would ask you to reflect at the very core of the word, are those systems doing that?
When my first book came out 3 years ago, and this is, so think about the world that, think about the fundraising world, not the philanthropy conversation, but the fundraising conversation that happened after. So in 2018, my book came out when AFP was in New Orleans, and that's where we gave away 450 copies of my book. And I immediately started to get a read on what was going on in this particular sort of professional group. And so in between April of 2018 and April of 2020, so that 2 year window, I heard things like, and remember, I'm teeing this up with this notion of Fieri's pedagogy of the oppressed. Remember, I was hearing things like, we have mental health issues. I heard Sam here on the podcast talking about imposter syndrome. I heard Heather Hill at CFRE talking about donor dominance. I'm hearing all of this sort of this ongoing narrative. And that's on top of, I had not addressed any of that in the first book because I thought because in my naive, white, straight male sort of head, I thought our problems were donor retention and professional turnover. That's all I thought the problems were. But then I put this book out here and it's missing all of these much more oppressive, much more marginalizing, much more destructive sort of things that were sort of undermining the opportunity for us to do very meaningful work. And I started to think about, okay, and the other thing is that I would join in these Facebook. So there's a Facebook group out there. You may be a member of it, Holly. There's a Facebook group out there with 450 fundraising professionals in that group. They kicked me out of the group because I challenged the thinking of one of their elites. They basically kicked me out. They said, you can't be a member of this group if you challenge the thinking of one of our sort of more superior leaders. And I thought, we've got a storytelling problem in this sector. And the storytelling is the experts who get the privilege of standing at the front of the room and doing exactly what Fieri was talking about. It's narration sickness. They're telling us the wrong story. And it's resulting in things like donor dominance and marginalization. It's the pedagogy of the oppressed.
I can't say that I disagree with some of the events, and the question is, this is bad. There's a lot of places I won't get involved or give my time because there's so much change that needs to be done.
Yes.
And I'm a change leader and I'm like, I just don't have energy for that right now. Like that is not where my energy, that's just not where I'm going to spend it.
I don't think you have to go sign up and be on anybody's committee. I think the thing is I think there's an emerging new generation of leadership that have a lifetime of, we'll say we have a half lifetime of experiences. They're people like yourself and myself who went to high school in the 1990s, who are perhaps not looking at the competing ideologies and deciding we're going to dig in our heels in one corner or the other, because that's what our parents taught us how to do. My parents taught me how to be on the right side of an argument. What I've actually learned how to do, having gone to college and graduate school, is actually learned how to understand what both sides of the argument are actually saying. And we need to build that into our thinking. That's why, we're 300 episodes in this and half of my guests don't agree with me, but half of my guests, I don't agree with them, and it gives me an opportunity to process what they're thinking. We need to build that into our fundraising practices.
That is totally, no, I agree with that. I also agree that I have the extraordinary privilege of a career where I intentionally made the choice where I would make moves that were right for me, where I could drive different agendas forward, right? Like I've never had to work in a hugely oppressive button down sort of culture. I've never not had to be out. I tested every job interview, hey, I'm queer. How's that going to work for you? By the way, I have kids and they're very important to me. So when I have to get called at 2 p.m. to go to daycare because somebody's puking, like that's going to be okay, right? I've tested all of the cultures that I've worked in. And it's a culture that I create with my own staff team today because I am a change leader, but I also need to know that the places that I'm working are going to be open and responsive to that testing and that change. And I think that is probably is a beautiful luxury that I recognize not every fundraiser gets,
Yeah. We could probably exhaust it. We're an hour in and we could probably keep ourselves going. Yeah. But I think we landed at a very good place. I think we're so much on the same page. We're coming from different sort of points of view in different parts of the world. But Holly, before I let you go, remind our listeners, you and I are going to both be in an event in Ottawa in a couple of weeks. And I don't have the dates and times in front of me, but can you remind everyone of where that's going to be?
So it is a virtual event this year. So you can sign up online and register at afpottawa.ca. It's a fundraising day. And that's on May 5th to 6th, 2021. So I believe the sessions are also recorded. So if you can't make it exactly at that time, you can always listen to them after. But, I think it's also $50 to register. So it's a pretty good use of your professional investment dollars. There's a couple of really great speakers like yourself, Jason, that I'm very excited to looking forward to hear what you have to say.
Holly, it has been a pleasure. You are always welcome back. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.